All of us are on a journey of becoming, a never-ending journey in pursuit of truth and deeper union with the divine. As you know, faith is a complicated thing, and this journey of becoming can be both difficult and painful. Far too often, we have not been given a space where we can safely address the complications and issues that arise naturally. My name is Joshua Patterson, and I am also on this journey of becoming. I am dedicated to inviting you into my story and creating a space where questions and critical thinking are welcome. I want to take an honest look at the issues and questions so common to this shared journey. I want to genuinely seek out what it means to follow Jesus in our ever-changing world, in our unfolding and expanding universe, and in our pluralistic society. I have come to know that doubt is not the enemy of faith, but rather that both doubt and curiosity are two of faith's biggest allies. I have learned that the Christian faith is more about wisdom and love than it is about correct doctrine or belief. And I believe that we are being invited to continually seek out both wisdom and love, renewing our minds, expanding our hearts, and rethinking our faith in the process. Thank you for joining me on that journey. All right. Well, welcome back to another episode of the Rethinking Faith podcast. As always, I'm your host, Josh Patterson. And with me today is a third time returning guest. Listeners, if you go back in the archives, you'll find a conversation called I See You. And then if you go a little, 2 years later, you might find a conversation called When We Stand. And then today, you should be listening to an episode titled All God's Children. And the thing that ties them all together is that Terrence Lester, the man behind all three of those titles, is hanging out with me once again today. Terrence, how are we doing, my friend?
Josh, it feels like it's been 6 years of... Right? literally. I'm excited to be here to... know you and to have this conversation. This is book three.
Yeah, that it's exciting. It's been really cool. I found a lot of joy in pulling all of your books off the shelf and kind of seeing them together. It just kind of reminded me not only of like watching your own story like happen and unfold, because I've been following you now like on social media and stuff for a while, but also just the conversations we've had and how different I am and I'm sure you are than when we first talked, all the way back in 2019. So it's kind of cool. I'm excited for this conversation.
Yeah, I am definitely different. I think both of us can attest to the fact that life is ever evolving with all of its hurdles and challenges and traumas and all of the things that can either shape us or make us bitter. So I am a different person today, and I am grateful for who I'm becoming.
Nice. Yeah, it's actually, it's crazy for listeners who might not know. I wanted to ask you about this just because it's been crazy to watch your journey in this particular aspect, but you were in like a pretty crazy car accident. And that like changed like a whole bunch of stuff for you. but I was with you along the way, kind of watching you as you progress through your very physical healing. I'm interested, like, did you learn anything, or like, maybe this is too big of a question, but like, what did you learn about maybe yourself during that time of like physical healing? And did it also tie into like, because I'm sure you got acclimated with your body maybe in some new ways, but also what kind, did it do anything for you like mentally too? Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great question. And for those who might be listening that don't follow me on social media, last May, it was actually What was it? May 14th, 2022. My wife and I had gone out to dinner to celebrate an award that our organization, Love Beyond Walls, was receiving on behalf of its work with the unhoused community. And it was a proud moment, man. You know, we got dressed all up. You know, I had on my, my blazer and my nice shoes, as my son would say. And we arrived and we just kind of relish in the fact that we were making progress. And when I say progress, not just progress for us, but progress in educating the public here in Atlanta about, how much we need to pay attention to those who are marginalized. And so we left, and I asked my wife to drive, and I fell asleep in the passenger car or passenger seat. And I remember the next thing I was doing was waking up on the ground with EMTs running over to my body. And I remember one EMT yelling out, "Flip him over to see if he's still alive." And I blacked out and I came to again. And I look up and I see a mangled car and my wife limping around the car to make it over to my body. I woke up again in the hospital with a surgeon standing over me, telling me that my femur had burst through my hip, broken my hip, and broke my pelvis. And I was, about to experience some severe nerve damage if they didn't operate quick. And so 10 hours later, I'm coming out of this operation with an ortho surgeon standing over me, telling me that it might be, a year to a year and a half before I could walk and move around. And I remember staying in the hospital for an entire month, and my life just like literally flipped upside down. And I want to make this statement because I think in that moment, it made me realize how much I had placed my worth in the idea of mobility. Because all my life, I had just been moving, and everything that I'd done in the work that I do in my organization, it just had all centered around worth. And it opened up this world of living with a disability and starting to see, how much ableism exists in the world and injustice towards those who don't have any movement. And so I had to sit with that. I had a lot of grief. There was a lot of impact from the trauma. And I started learning things about myself, as well as grief, that just kind of started me on this journey of wanting to take steps towards becoming and healing and being okay with the fact that life doesn't happen in a vacuum, right? And life isn't scripted all the time, and it's okay to embrace the journey before me. And so I realized that trauma and grief and loss did not take my worth away, and that's important because even though I could not move, it did not mean that I didn't have worth or I had any less worth, right? I realized that I didn't have to be ashamed for grieving in public, right? And sometimes, like, we live in a society that tries to like sweep things under a rug or give you some like prescriptive way of overcoming really quick. And I learned that grief doesn't have an expiration date and it's not linear, and it's okay for a person to like lean into their own sense of emotions and the way that they grieve or the way that I grieve, right? I no longer had to rush my pain or take someone else's steps to navigate the grief that was unique to me. And then lastly, man, it was just like understanding that, I had to give myself grace. And when I say grace, I mean permission to be in the moment of what I was experiencing without expectations, without agendas, without any of those things, and really sit with where I was in life. And I think that has produced deeper compassion in me. So I said a lot, but that's a little bit about that.
Dang, dude, that'll fucking preach. Oh man, thank you for sharing all of that. Also, I apologize for using foul language, but that's
No, you're bro.
man, that thank you for sharing. Like, there's so much just even packed into that. Man, that's listeners, you're welcome. That's the cost of admission for this episode. Like, man, the yeah, Terrence, thank you for sharing. I mean, I'm left without words, but there's so much, man, I don't know, just the like honesty and wisdom and I mean I was really taken back just kind of when you started talking about finding worth in like mobility. Because I've been kind of, like patting myself on the back and be like, oh, good job, Josh. You've kind of moved on from having your worth tied to vocation. Because I had a hard time when I stopped being a pastor. I thought like, oh, my entire identity was wrapped up in pastor. Now I'm a brewer. But that job is deeply physical, and if I didn't have my mobility, I couldn't do it. And so like I was very much like I convicted, to use Christian language, caught back, like I'm gonna have to spend time and contemplate on that one, man. And we haven't even gotten to your new book. But yeah, thank you for sharing.
Yeah, no problem, man. I just think something that you just lifted up is so important. That mobility or immobility does not dictate whether we are worth it or if we are a gift or not. And I think society has, I mean, even in how we design buildings, I remember times like, when I was in my wheelchair with my family, like there were literally buildings that I could not go into because it wasn't ADA accommodating, or, times when I would be out in public and, there would be other people who would make fun of me and my disability when I was using my walker, in front of my kids and my family, or say things like that was just really disgusting. And I think somehow we have allowed the way that we have placed value just on mobility, like these really external things, or the ability to do things. We've allowed those to dictate worth. And I've always been of the notion, like even in my book, I see you, we need to start with the inherent worth and value of every person. And I'm there even more right now. And it's just made me even more aware and sensitive to all types of groups that have been excluded just by how we l use language and design things. So thank you, man, for sharing that thought.
Yeah, that like talk about proximity, right? Which is a you have a whole chapter about it in your book, but this is crazy because it's like a lived out example. Not so within the in the book, you're talking about proximity in regards to race relations and that like that whole the conversation around racism. But this like as I'm hearing you talk, it's like you very quickly and not necessarily according to your own will, very quickly got put into proximity with people who do experience these kind of like a society that's not built for the kind of body that they have. That's yeah, that's interesting. That's crazy. But
yeah, and it's like it's so powerful, man. Even like I know you probably have more questions, but I live in a black body too. And I am constantly reminded of the distance and the lack of proximity that people who are white have to me, or even the history that shapes me. And when I say white people, I'm not talking about all white people, because there are some who are very much co-conspirators and stand in solidarity with black and brown communities. But just the way that this society has been historically shaped, I am constantly reminded. I'm so constantly reminded that, you know, here recently, one of the things that I was talking about in a talk, I during my whole process of healing, I couldn't walk. I was in a PhD program. I still was able to complete my PhD. I defended my dissertation like a couple months after, you know, being able to walk. And here recently, I was just on a call, right, with predominantly white persons, and everybody on the call had a PhD, including myself. And a middle-aged white woman literally called everybody doctor on the call except me. And you know, it's just like kind of those moments. Not that, you know, I'm just gung-ho about a title, but in a professional setting, you know, I deserve the same type of acknowledgement as anybody else. But I'm constantly reminded, like you're saying, like whether it's a body that's living with a disability or a black body or brown body, there seems to be this notion in society and culture where certain types of bodies are excluded, not acknowledged, and not affirmed in ways that is healthy. Does that make
Yeah, absolutely. And that what's crazy about that story that you shared on the call is like you within your book, you share like 50 other stories just like that. So it's not like a one-time anomaly
Yeah.
Kind of phenomenon. And also it kind of reminds me too. I mean, this is something you get to later in the book when you mentioned critical race theory, but the trying to combine the experience that you had from the car accident and then having to figure out what living like with what much less mobility looked like, and also the fact that you're a black man, that when people talk about intersectionality, that's kind of like that's like would be an example of that, right? That's these two things coming together. And so now it's also it's I'm a black man also with this like now like less mobility than I used to have. So that's when people talk about intersectionality, that's kind of what that's like the idea behind it, right?
Yeah, that's a perfect example. So the way I like to describe it is like in some of my roles, right? I'm a husband, I'm a father, you know, I am a leader, but I'm one person. And so like there are any given times or moments like where all of those things can converge and have impact on this one person at the same time. And I think that is the idea of what intersectionality means. So like even being black in the hospital where I was, I didn't receive the best care. And there's research, right, that shows that in the healthcare system, there's this idea that black people don't have real pain, which is, you know, ideology steeped in white supremacy over, you know, decades of, I mean, even if you read Dr. Joy DeGruy's work, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, she talks about how Black bodies were experimented on in medicine early on, et cetera. But I did not have the best experience. I had nurses that wouldn't give me pain medication, that would literally steal my medication and ghost me when I was in agony and pain. There were times when I would have healthcare professionals come in and literally curse at me, right? And not even know me. And so while I'm Black, I'm also living with a disability, but I'm also being impacted by the healthcare industry that sometimes discriminates against Black bodies. So like, you can see how all of that converges on one person or a group of people, right? With their own unique experiences. And most people don't understand intersectionality because they have the option or the privilege to compartmentalize different aspects of their life.
Yeah, that's crazy. That's a really helpful kind of image and way of framing that. And we might come back and touch on critical race theory again, but I know that wasn't like the main, you know, thesis of your book. But listeners, if you are interested and don't know much about critical race theory, or maybe that's a scary phrase or something like that, a little while ago I did an episode with Propaganda called I Almost Didn't Do This, and it was about critical race theory, but Prop was very honest when we started, and he was like, dude, I almost didn't do this because I'm tired of explaining to white people what critical race theory is. And he was like, but I like you guys are cool, so I decided I'd come hang out. But the episode, yeah, listeners, so that's there if you're interested. And I'm ADHD as I'll get out, and now my brain is in a million different places. I'm trying to trace where I want to go. I'm going to focus here. You have your new book, we've already mentioned it, but it's called All God's Children: How Confronting Buried History Can Build Racial Solidarity. And one thing that I absolutely love about how you started the book, the introduction, was about story, which is something that we've kind of already like started this episode off with is story. But the intro is called Everyone Has a Story. And that's story here on Rethinking Faith is huge. Like, I think story is the game. I'm curious, why is story so important to you? Why do you find story and making the statement everybody has a story, why is that important?
Yeah. I'll never forget years ago, my wife and a few of our friends were headed downtown. We were going to some major event, and we were all kind of using public transportation because it was going to be crowded and we didn't want to park in like the expensive parking lots, right? And so we are on this train, and we're kind of sitting adjacent to this guy who is like literally his head is down. He's very sad, and he has these little kids with him, and they're just like, you know, like being kids, like, you know, touching people, like rolling on the floor, you know, swinging on the poles, you know, taking their book bags. They were just like doing all sorts of things. And I kind of look across and see this group of people like talking about this man, right? Just like whispers that weren't really whispers. They were like really loud. he's a bad parent. He's like, why would you let your kids do this? And finally, he lifts up his head with tears in his eyes and says, "I just found out my wife passed." And I'll let you pause and sit with that. Because that is what I mean by the power of story. We don't know what has shaped someone. We don't know their experiences. We don't know their history. We don't know what it is that they are carrying in the moment, what they have had to journey through. We may not even know the history of the culture that they may emerge from. And when I say understanding story, I think story gives us access to be even more proximate, to literally sit with the humanity of the people who are in front of us. It literally gives us the type of proximity where we can love neighbor, and not just to use that Christian language, not to love neighbor as some cliche thing that we pull from scripture, but love the essence of what a person has had the journey through. Love the essence of what a person is fearing in the moment. Love the essence of all of the dualities of life that may be present in someone's story, you know? And it also gives us insights into how a person has been shaped or impacted or moved in some way. I don't think we can truly get proximate to people without understanding story. And for the Christians who may be learning or listening, you know, I think Jesus himself models the idea of story best when he's telling parables and he's asking people who he approaches and is proximate to about themselves that allows them to assert their sense of humanity in their cultural context. And sometimes in, you know, America or the US, we believe stories about people that we assume. We make up stories. We allow embedded ideas about people inform how we show up to either treat people or view people or judge people or criminalize people or any of the isms that we have been framed by. And what I'm kind of trying to get at is just lay the foundation in this book to say, if you truly want to be in solidarity with someone, if you truly want to be about racial justice or the work of conciliation, if you truly want to love your neighbor, you cannot do that with being distant from their story.
Yeah, I love the kind of like a common thread that you wove throughout there. And also, I think it's a common thread that is throughout all of your work, is this idea of humanizing the other and how
Yes.
story humanizes people. And that has been helpful for me in my own life in a wide variety of ways. Just, you know, thinking about for example, so both of my brothers are in the LGBTQ community. My one brother is gay, my other brother is pansexual. And by being in relationship with them, that helped move my ideas and understandings, you know, my thoughts, theories about LGBTQ, you know, plus kind of questions, into like an embodied experience and reality. It wasn't just this idea I had anymore, but rather it's a part of my everyday. It's a part of my experience. And then on top of that, it opened me up to asking questions about like trans folks, for example. And I didn't you know, I didn't fully, I mean, I still don't fully understand, but I didn't understand. But by being in the kind of spaces with my brother or like just other spaces that I've been in, I've become friends with trans folks. And then that, again, the proximity, the story, the humanizing shifts things. It changes things. It takes things out of just ideas for me and brings them into my embodied experience. And I remember too, even just kind of more so in line with the topic of your book, my buddy Keith is a pastor, him and his wife, pastor in like a predominantly white congregation in Ohio. And Keith and his wife are both Black. And after, I remember after the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, Keith invited me onto a Zoom call with Keith, and there was a panel of probably six other gentlemen, age ranging from like 15 or 16 up to like, I don't know, he could be my grandfather. And all that happened was story was shared, and the people on the panel were the only people that could talk, and everybody else was just there to hear the story and listen. And that, I've shared that story on this podcast many times, but I will never forget that experience. That shifted something in me, brought me into the story of things I didn't even have concept or idea about. Like in your book, you talk about having to have the talk with your son. And that's something I've never had to experience. But that came up in that conversation, you know? And so like that, I don't know. It just, yeah, the story is everything. And it's been like life changing. So I appreciate that aspect of your work.
Yeah. You know, I try to put myself in the work as much as I am trying to drop things in that either people may not be aware of or they may be aware of, but don't necessarily know how it impacts a person who is living this in real time. I'll never forget going over to my grandmother's house. I was 10 years old. And it was the first time my grandfather had like a talk with me. Like I still can remember, like I feel chills in my body because I can see the furniture and like feel the air and smell the breakfast that my grandmother was cooking. And like I remember my grandfather's hands. He passed away a couple years ago, but I can still see like the wrinkles in his hand, and like out of nowhere, he leans over to me as we're about to eat. And he says, you know, this world is going to be hard for you and you're going to be mistreated because of the color of your skin. Like that was the first time, like I really had to wrestle as a 10-year-old boy with the idea of a racialized construct, right? The first time I encountered like race itself was when I heard my mom talking on the phone about the Rodney King beating that happened in 1991. And, you know, hearing her say things like, they did what to him? Why do they treat us like that? And realizing that it was something to the color of my skin, but like sitting there across from my grandfather and him like telling me these things, like I don't even know if my 10-year-old brain fully understood that. But I started to realize that it had something to do with the way that we you know were created and how we were in our Black bodies. And you know, later I found out that this talk itself is sort of like a rite of passage for Black children. And basically, you know, Black parents, Black grandparents, the Black villages kind of communicating to Black children that, you know, you will be seen as a threat and you have to learn how to live, right? To kind of mitigate the potential harm, right? And so like when Black people have collective trauma, when we see like an Ahmaud Arbery or a Breonna Taylor, like that shared trauma stems from the history, our history, collective history, but it also stems from like these very young encounters with these conversations that in many ways produces fear, right? Like, I remember the fear I felt when I was 10 hearing these things. And, you know, now fast forward, like I talk about in this book, now I'm in the driver's seat, right? And as much as I have gained education, you know, worked hard to like protect my children from those realities, there's nothing I can do to protect them because it just is a reality. And when my son sees the knee on the neck of George Floyd and sees tanks on the television at 9 years old, he asks me why. And it's a conversation that is embarrassing as a Black father, as a Black parent, because you don't want to have to tell the truth about the reality of what could possibly happen to you as you continue to grow up and become a Black man. And so the talk is still impacting me and informing me even to this day. But everybody has been given a talk, right? Everybody has a storyline. Even if you're not Black, if you're white, maybe that talk was directly, maybe the talk was indirectly, hearing other people talk about other races or groups of people. Maybe that talk was, you know, nonverbal, right? Because nonverbal communication is still communication. The way that you treat someone, the way that you saw other people in your family treat other people who came from a different social location. And so that is so essential, man, because I think sometimes we don't understand how talking heads or news media clips or the banning of books in the state of Florida or the coded language all is communicating the talk and is influencing how we show up either to distance ourselves from or stand in solidarity with people who have been oppressed in this country.
Yeah, man, that it's like that like brings into frame like very vividly just this the kind of difference between like the implicit versus like the explicit like forms of like racism that are still present. Because I very much, even as you were talking, there are, I don't think I was ever explicitly taught racist ideas. Like my parents, like I grew up around a diverse group of people, but there very much still were implicit things taught or things that I look back on today now. Like I remember as you were talking, asked like wanting to go to the mall to get like something. I asked my grandmother if we could go, and she said, oh well, no, like you know, around this time it gets dark in the mall. And I thought she was telling me that they turn the lights off, but that's not what she was implying. And so like things like this, yeah, that man, yeah, that just kind of come to mind. And then too, that All of that plays nicely, and you have a whole section in the book about bias. And a lot of these biases too are not necessarily just explicit or taught. They're demonstrated through actions, like the people, I guess, your parents have over for dinner, or who they don't. maybe these kind of things. Yeah, and it's just, I don't know. It's such a complex. It's a complicated conversation, but at the same time, it's not. I don't know. I'm not finding myself with good or helpful words. But I think
bro, and I hear that, and I want to ask you, what are you feeling in this moment? Because normally you are a man of many words. So how is the conversation impacting you?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's hard to put into words because I'm good at theorizing. I'm good at reading and learning ideas and trying to communicate complex ideas. But when those ideas, like I was saying earlier, no longer come ideas, but rather are things I'm experiencing in the moment, it becomes difficult, especially when it's not something, it's not an experience that I personally have had. And then it's like, oh shit, well, what do I do now? Like, what do I say? What don't I say? you know, and more so, I just, it gets me thinking back and just, you know, remembering my own experiences and upbringings or conversations I've had with, you know, like friends growing up. Yeah. So it's just, it hits me differently and it becomes emotional, and then it just is no longer easy just to converse about things as if they're just ideas. It becomes very real, wow, very quick. Does that make sense? Because then I could keep asking you about theories and ideas, but this but like you have a bit about moving from like head to heart or the embodiment of the ideas. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that is the essence of everything that you just explained, is the essence of why I wrote this. Because it's in that feeling that you draw closer to the story of another person, that you're able to cultivate this sense of solidarity, where it's lamenting with others, you know, in a real, not in a like a superficial way, but like we're on Zoom right now and I can feel the closeness of the conversation and how we are converging or having this intersectional moment from two different totally social locations, social upbringings, all of this, but we are at this like critical moment where we are left to reflect with, what do we do with this, right? How do we continue to cultivate these types of conversations, but also invite other people who haven't had this space to do this type of work? You know, listening to others and learning from others and immersing yourself into the story of another, right? Right, where it kind of positions you to be empathetic or show compassion, right? And I think that creates this kind of like pathway for us to stand with others and use our voice to speak truth to power, as in a form of, you know, truth telling, as Jamar Tisby says, is like the beginning of repair. Like we are able to repair or reorient the ways that we have been socially fashioned to believe things about this particular subject. Or, you know, man, I just think, I thank you for sharing the story, even about your grandmother. And I don't even know how hard that was for you to share, but I think that is important because, you know, I think about the countless of other people who have been communicated to in that way, but they, it just like went over their heads and they weren't really able to sit with that talk that they were given.
Yeah. Well, thank you for putting yourself out there in the way that you did, not only in the conversation, but also within your book. Cause I mean, I know we keep coming back to story, but you shared like countless stories throughout your book. And every time I found myself getting angry or upset, not only thinking about yourself in that situation, but also thinking about, you know, some of my like really good friends, and like placing them in those kind of situations, or make me cry on the damn podcast, Terrence. It's messed up. But I remember even just talking to my friend Javaska, who Jay, I've been friends with him since we met in high school when we worked in a grocery store together. And Jay has two boys, and he's in an interracial relationship, which already causes issues for some people. And then, like, even as you're talking, I haven't thought about this in a while, but Javaska told me about having to explain this kind of story to his two kids, and like they're young, like they're JJ and JoJo are like 7 or 8 and like 4, maybe somewhere around there. And so like it becomes, again, it's taking that, I like, because you again, you talk about proximity later in the book, but it is kind of that proximity. And then these are real relationships in my life, and so they, you know, they carry, you know, understanding like leads to compassion. And I think you say compassion then leads to solidarity, where we can then actually start talking about things like reconciliation. Yeah, it's just, I don't know. It gets emotional pretty quickly. And then even too, just kind of the idea seems to be coming to mind that you talk about in the book about sitting at like another person's table, basically. Which I really liked that, because you kind of, you called something out that I didn't really notice before, where it's like, you know, a lot of times people, white people like myself, have this tendency to say, oh, like, we want diversity and inclusion. Come join us at our table. But then that still, it ties into this like kind of the inherent white supremacy, because it's still like, oh, I own the table still. You're just now allowed to come sit at it. And you can say something, maybe I'll take it in consideration, maybe. But kind of flipping that on its head. And now I feel like I'm trying to enter into like, okay, I want to go sit at Terrence's table now and see what Terrence has to say. Instead of just inviting everybody to what Josh has to say and think all the time. So that I don't know. This conversation kind of feels like that to me. Yeah.
That's deep, bro, because it's what you just said is the start of repair, because sitting at another person's table, or this idea of decentering yourself, makes you vulnerable, but it also puts you in a place to learn more than you ever had. When you own the table, you control the script. I've been in part of these conversations. You get to dictate what is said and what is not said. You get to police the tone, right? You get to do what one pastor in Atlanta said, co-opt a word and transform a word called white privilege into white blessing. You get to, you know what I mean? And it's repair is difficult. Repair is vulnerable. Repair takes work. Repair is messy. Repair takes standing with people and being proximate enough to feel the weight of what they experience on a day-to-day, second-by-second basis. Repair is about learning a new way of understanding, which creates a pathway to be even more proximate. Repair is about building friendships and knowing the names of your friends' children and sitting with that on a podcast and feeling that emotion to be able to have the courage to continue to tell truth, even to those who may look like you. That's what repair is all about, bro. And that's what I appreciate about you and what I've always appreciated about this podcast.
Well, thank you. I don't know. I don't know. I think these kind of conversations are difficult, and you know, I'm stumbling over my words more than I typically would. But I just can't get over past experience of just how deeply forming and meaningful conversations like this have been for myself, and even too, just to share one more story that's coming to mind. That was just super interesting. I have a buddy named Mike, and Mike used to be a patron at Full Tilt, the brewery that I used to work at until it got closed down, unfortunately, due to like COVID complications, things like this. And Mike's a really good friend. He invited me over to his house for a bonfire the other day, probably like a month ago. And it was myself and probably like seven other people. And I was the only white dude there. And it was funny because people started making fun of me a little bit. Like, how did you get invited kind of thing? But then it was really interesting because the conversation kind of shifted and it got really deep and real really quickly. But then Mike and Mike's friends, people I had met some of them before, but like three of them I had never met before, invited me into the conversations still, without knowing who I was. And like, that was like another like formative kind of just like, holy shit. You know, like you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
Until you know it. And so like, I'm, you know, in the, this conversation made me think about that. And I hadn't thought about it in that way yet, but like, I'm grateful for like someone like Mike to invite me into this conversation, or even if it was unintentional. Mike is a smart dude. I don't think Mike does things unintentionally, even though he might like to pretend that maybe sometimes he does.
And then, you know, wow. What type of relationship did you have with Mike for Mike to feel safe enough to invite you to the table? You know, I think that is, you know, one of the essence of what I'm getting at is that when you stand with people, you build relationships with people, you learn from people, you learn with people. That type of trust and safety is established where deeper and more meaningful conversations can take place, where both persons are formed, you know, and impacted. And I think, you know, even in hearing that story, Bro, I would invite you to a cookout too, you know? And that's on everything I love. Yep.
I would definitely come through. I haven't been to Atlanta before. I've driven through it once, when we were fleeing a hurricane in Florida. But that's not good, you know. It's not a good
Yeah.
wasn't a good time. But I'm before we kind of like started this like recording the conversation, you had asked me about like, because I was telling you about like how process thinking has been meaningful to me recently. And one way that I think that comes to mind that ties into this conversation, I think nicely for why process relational thinking is helpful, is basically within process, like one of the ideas is that you can't understand the whole without understanding the individuals, and also you can't understand an individual without understanding the whole. So it's deeply relational. And so once that kind of recognition comes into play, I think it can tie into something I think is interesting, and you talk about in the book, because oftentimes you hear in Christian circles, specifically white Christian circles, when something like Black Lives Matter is said, they'll be like, oh, well, like all lives matter, Jesus died for everybody kind of thing. And what's interesting is, from within a process relational framework, you very quickly realize that if people are saying all lives matter, but each of those individual lives aren't being taken care of, then it's bullshit. All lives can't matter until each individual life matters. Or as like my friend Roberto Shea Espinoza, as he uses this language of what bodies count. And he likes to talk about imagining a better world where every body counts. But like everybody can't count until each individual body does. And maybe we can imagine a better world where one day somebody could say something like all lives matter, and that is true based off lived experience. But until that day, like, we got some work
Until that day,
to
a lot of work to do, brother. Lots of work. Yeah.
I don't know. But yeah, I feel like process gives me a helpful way of looking at that, because then I don't know. Anyway, that's me trying to intellectualize things, because I move away from emotion because I'm an Enneagram type 7, and that's
Okay. I'm an eight.
what I do. Yeah, I'm a 7 wing
Yeah.
8.
Okay.
But I don't know, man. Terrence, thank you so much for this conversation and for your work, and the continued work that you do. I love following you on social media, because I don't know, social media is one of those places that can be so like volatile. But I don't know. Following your feed always brings me like hope and encouragement and joy, even with the kind of difficult conversations you challenge people to. So please keep doing what you're
I
doing.
appreciate that, man. Yeah. Thank you, man. I appreciate you. I appreciate your wisdom, this podcast, and all of the meaningful conversations that will continue to educate and inform people, hopefully to push people in proximate relationships with all of their neighbors, because
Yes.
everybody counts, right?
Yes. Yeah, amen.
I was going to ask you though, man.
Yeah, go for it.
I don't know if anybody listens to this, maybe two people or so. I would love to gift two people with all three books.
Oh, sure.
And we can do that.
That'd
Just
be
let me
awesome.
know how you want to give them away. We can mail them directly to them. But I appreciate you. This is our third conversation. It's in the archives, brother.
In the archives. It's on a record down in history. That's another cool thing about process is the past is now objectively immortal. So this conversation exists forever perfectly within the divine nature, and it's a beautiful thing. There we go. Yeah.
That's awesome.
We'll make that happen. And also I'll be sure to link your work in the show notes. I'll also link Love Beyond Walls. It's such an awesome organization that people should check out. And then one day we're gonna have to figure out a time for Love Beyond Walls to come hang out in Baltimore. And
oh, for sure.
I'll be there.
Yeah, for sure. I would love that.
Cool.
Yeah. We gotta make that happen for real.
Yeah, I'm down. And the brewery that I'm at now, they're really big on community involvement and engagement, and we have a space that could host something like that, so we could totally make it happen if breweries are acceptable meeting places.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely. Yeah. Yeah.
Sick. Sweet, man. Well, thank you again for everything. And listeners, thanks for hanging out today. Thanks for putting up with my ramblings as Terrence challenged me and brought me into a place of vulnerability. So thanks for hanging out, guys. And as always, go in peace.